Okay, thank you, Brian. Thanks to the organizers for the opportunity to be back in Santa Barbara. Fantastic venue. So I'm going to talk about vector boson production. So the reason for talking about this is just coming from thinking about what's next for the LHC. Well, of course, we're all interested in learning more about the Higgs, continued searches for SUSY, other exotics, precision studies of the top quark. And when you think about all of those things, then of course, vector bosons are important to understand. Sort of enter everywhere in the case of the Higgs boson, backgrounds to top production, multi-lepton final states, all those sorts of things. So, I mean, these are sort of the themes that I'll try and address. I mean, I don't have answers to all of these questions. If I did, then we wouldn't all be here. But part of what we're trying to understand now is how to use all the tools that we've developed over the years and how we can further refine them. And in particular, I think what's interesting to think about is, once we think we have accurate predictions, what else do we have to go back and rethink? What becomes important when the corrections become small or the uncertainties become small? What becomes the leading effect? And what approximations can we lift to help address that? But it's not just backgrounds, it's probes of the standard model as well. Part of what we're thinking about here, and we already heard mention of the weak mixing angle and the W mass. So that's part of the program. And another part, which I'll touch on later, is how we probe the electroweak sector and try and decide whether what we're seeing is the standard model Higgs. Is there something else out there? Are the couplings slightly different from the standard model? And we've known for a long time that one of the ways of addressing that is trying to probe vector boson scattering. So this is not a new idea. This is a little quote taken from the proceedings of a meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science when Lord Kelvin was president. And this is sort of preaching to the choir, but what he says is, accurate and minute measurement seems to the non-scientific imagination a less lofty and dignified work than looking for something new. But then he goes on to say, but almost all the grand discoveries have been the rewards of accurate measurements, long-continued labor, and minute sifting of numerical results. And I think all of us here can agree that those are things that we're somewhat invested in. And so I sort of had this in mind when I was thinking about the topic. So Kelvin was 145 years ago maybe one of the proponents of this program, so I sort of stuck his name on the end. I understand he had to decline. Okay, so I'm going to start off with a short description of some of the advances in describing the Drell-Yan processes. So I'm not going to be completely comprehensive here, but try and pick out things which I find interesting and point to the sort of state of the art. So of course, these are processes that we've known to next to leading order QCD for some time, and including resummation effects, and indeed higher order corrections in the electroweak theory. And that's going to be discussed later on this week. So I'll try and not steal all of Fulvio's thunder. But one of the interesting things is how do you combine this information? And it's something that's, for instance, is contained in FUSE, so full electroweak corrections in addition to next to leading order QCD, here displayed in the resonance region. And here is a more recent calculation off the resonance region, just looking at the weak effects and not the photon contributions. And what's shown in this lower panel here is the uncertainty on the next to leading order QCD result, and then two different ways of combining with the electroweak contributions. And you can see that, of course, when the QCD corrections are large out in the tail here, there's a difference between the 10 or 20% correction from these higher order corrections. And this is work in progress, should come out soon. we're not just stuck at fixed next to next to leading order. We also know how to do combination with a Parson shower, and at least a couple of ways of doing that, and with different treatments of how you extend the shower to next to leading order precision, and what type of configurations receive those corrections, and indeed a further treatment I'm sure we'll hear about from Christian later this week. Of course, ideally, we wouldn't have any approximate combination of QCD and electroweak effects. We would actually just compute them from scratch. So we'd have calculations of these mixed order alpha, alpha S corrections, like this guy here. We don't quite know how to do that, but the two-loop integrals are, as of a couple of months ago, or last month even, those integrals are now known. But we can almost get there using the Prowl approximation. And we know that that works pretty well in electroweak calculations of the past. And these plots just show a comparison of this exact result, the red curve, with these various approximations. And there are significant differences, but those differences do occur where we know the QCD corrections have some problem describing this distribution here. At this peak, so I think the jury's a little bit out, but we're getting there. And why is this so important? One reason, we talked about the W mass already, and so this is just a study of what the impact of these corrections would have on trying to extract the W mass. So this is just a theory study, so there's some shortcomings, but it gives an idea of the sort of size of the effect you might expect. And so you see that when you go from leading order to including the next leading order corrections, you have some shift, but this shift is the shift from having the full result is about the same as the shift from just combining these naively, so it's important to treat these properly for extracting this mass. It's not shown here, but this is also as large as the shift as you get from multi-photon corrections, from photos. And of course the shift, the size of this, is sort of bigger than what we might hope to maybe get to at the LHC eventually. So you really want to include these effects exactly. We also heard how LHCb could help this morning. This idea that by exploiting this greater rapidity range, you reduce the sensitivity to the PDFs. And so the claim here is again in a sort of exploratory study that maybe just by including the LHCb results, you improve the determination of the W mass by 25%. Which is a pretty big deal, and I'm sure we'll hear more about this later in the week as well. So it's not just the theory, it's learning how to use the theory in this and thinking about it in new ways. So that's for Joanne. Now let me turn to photons. So of course, everyone's been interested in calculation of discussing diphoton production, and so here I'm just going to show a few results that Joey already flashed up on the computation of diphoton production at next to next to leading order. So this is something that we did a few months ago. We found a slightly different result than existed in the literature, but we also checked this pretty well. We're using this jettiness approach that Joey mentioned, and I'm sure will be discussed by Frank later on, and also by Walter. So I'm going to focus a bit more on the phenomenology. One of the things that we included was thinking about subtle effects that hadn't previously been accounted for in the next to leading order calculation. One of those is these corrections through loops of light quarks, and this is something that would enter at n cubed ELO, so that was originally investigated by Zvi and Lance and others a long time ago, 10 or 15 years ago. But we combined it with the next-to-next leading order calculation, and we also looked at the effect of not at not these partial n cubed LO, but the leading order loops of top quarks, and including the mass effect here. And so what you see, this is a comparison, this is the ratio to the pure n squared LO. So the red line is when you include these partial corrections to the light loops. The green is when you include the top loop. And the sort of thinking was that, of course, you're going to get some enhancement at the top threshold and slightly above. So it sort of looks sort of vaguely interesting as you approach 600 or 700 GeV. But of course, the effect is at the percent level. So if you're interested in trying to describe big discrepancies with data, this doesn't do much for you. But this sort of few percent distortion, small shape change, you know, is going to be interesting eventually. And Joey already showed this, but I think it's important to emphasize that the ability of having an ab initio calculation that essentially gives you the same curve as the fits used by Atlas and also by CMS, I think is quite valuable. This is just a shape. It wouldn't be so different just using an absolute prediction. I mean, the difficulty is that we have no fake rates, no efficiencies folded in here. So we felt on less safe ground to do that. No, of course not. In fact, I mean, you would expect to do better out here, I believe, but I haven't been able to sufficiently convince an experimentalist that that I knew what I was doing.
One of the slides I cut out of my talk, one of the many slides I cut out, an isolated electromagnetic object is a photon theory. Right? Jets don't fade. You're not going to have a 350 GeV by zero, 5 GeV of additional. If you see something that's a photon, chances are it is a photon.
So it's interesting to see also a comparison of more canonical regions of phase space, so lower invariant masses. This is comparison with CMS data at 7 TeV. And what you see by including, the agreement's pretty good. These are the ratios down at the bottom. There's some evidence that adding in these partial corrections to the GG channels actually helps. In some cases, for instance, if you look at the transverse momentum distribution of the gamma-gamma pair, that's of course something that's trivial at leading order, which is what the GG to gamma-gamma looks like. But once you include the higher order corrections, they then should have a bigger effect, and indeed they do. And this looks like there's some shape difference in this distribution that appears to get patched up when you include this. So, there's always healthy debate, let's say, about whether including partial higher order terms is a useful thing to do. But I think here, there's some evidence that the data really likes to do that. Yes?
The difference is biggest at low PT. So what if you just resum? What if you just included a partial hour without
the shutdown? Yeah. I mean, you would think that. I mean, there's a region here where you might not think that's important, but certainly if you get down to 10 and below, sure.
I mean, it's the photon shower really doesn't need to find a leading order matrix correction. So Sherpa does a good job describing the low-PT region, but it does so because of the matrix elements that it includes. If you remove those and just use the photon shower, then it doesn't do such a good job.
But I would say, there's agreement here, these bins down here, that's sort of right. Yeah. I'm not going to judge it based on that, that's right.
Low PT also has a fragmentation problem, so you have time period,
not the balance
or scale variation or scale? So it's just scale, actually, yeah. So there's some PDF wiggle too.
The central scale is amplitude.
It is, yes. Of course, there's more than just diphotons. You can look at vector boson plus photons. This is something that's known to next to leading order. There, the corrections are relatively moderate, and especially once you start putting a jet veto on. So this is the right-hand plot here, where the difference between the, say, the green and the red is rather small. And this is taken from a recent ATLAS analysis. Since Joey showed a lot of theory, I feel I can show some experiments too. So the agreement is pretty good here. And like I said, I don't want to get too deep into the electroweak corrections, but it would be remiss of me to not mention that they've been also been computed. They're significant compared to QTD, particularly in the case of a jet veto, so the results that we were just looking at. So if we concentrate on this plot on the right, these are the QTD corrections completely inclusively as a percentage in the red curve and for a veto in green. And you see that, you know, once you apply a veto and look at very hard photons, then QTD does almost nothing, whereas the electroweak corrections get to be huge. Now, in the plot I just showed, essentially we're really only probing photon PTs up to about 200 GeV or so, with any statistics, that is. So you're sort of at 10% corrections, but you know, you're really going into a region in the future where this could be the dominant effect. WZ production is, of course, a close friend of W photon, also something included here because it's very recent calculation, a recent study. Just like in W gamma, you have an approximate radiation zero, so it sort of enhances the contribution of the higher order QTD corrections. And you sort of see a trend here when you go from the blue to the pink, the pink to the blue, that the agreement looks somewhat improved. Okay, so now I'll move on to production of W and Z pairs. So of course, I mean, this is a color singlet production, so you would think, you know, just like Drell-Yan, we've known how to do it for a number of years. Of course, the missing ingredients were the two-loop helicity amplitudes, and they were computed a year or two ago, and used to provide the first phenomenology at that order, and pointing out important effects, like how to deal with the contamination from top quark processes, not just top pairs, but single top as well. Recently, that's been updated using this matrix framework, which is a general framework for doing calculations at next to leading order, accounting for singly resonant diagrams, also a full set of contributions when you have same flavor leptons, so you need to put ZZ in as well. And the point they emphasize there is that one that people have begun to appreciate over the last few years, that the, you know, there can be a really significant difference when you look at inclusive cross sections and fiducial ones, and that has an effect on the efficiencies when you take the ratio of the two, essentially, that these change by order a few percent. So it's something that we know about, but good to emphasize. Just like in diphotons, where you can think about doing corrections to a contribution that appears at the next to leading order, these glue to dibosons, you can also do it here for WW. Here it's more complicated, of course. I mean, the photons are massless, W's are not. You also might worry about putting the third generation in. In fact, it's a pretty good approximation to ignore the third generation, which is just as well, because then you'd have to deal with the top mass as well, which makes it somewhat harder. So you can ask, what's the effect of putting these contributions in? And you see a big correction from these terms, so sort of a 50% correction. On the grand scheme of things, it's not so big. In fact, when you again go to fiducial cuts, which we've learned is really the thing to do, that the correction is even more mild. So an important thing to include, but it's going to be a while before we're going to be probing at this sort of level of accuracy. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, of course. And again, the electroweak corrections are there for the WW process, and I won't go over it here except to point out they can be rather large again due to the single resonant contributions. ZZ production also next to leading order. And again, you want to worry about the glue-glue channel. You already know that in this case, the bulk of the next to leading order comes from these glue-glue contributions. So again, you can go beyond and compute these partial N cubed LO effects, and that's what's shown here, computed just towards the end of last year. Again, the electric corrections are there, and there's again, emphasizing the point that you've got to, the electroweak corrections are not a blanket number you can apply. You really, you can have positive corrections in one region and negative in another. So here what happens with the glue-glue loops, it's sort of the same story. Again, it's the correction is rather large when you include the higher order effect. It's these corrections, of course, are even bigger at 13 TeV, but you can see even with the relative precision of 8 TeV, we're not really probing at that level yet, and certainly what we have at 13, we're not either, but we will. Here, there is quite a big difference. Okay, so now I'm going to go on to something dear to my heart, off-shell studies. So here, the idea is to look at these diboson processes not on resonance, but for instance, if we look at four lepton production, so with the ZZ channel, and look at the cross-section as a function of the four lepton invariant mass, then of course there's a whole spectrum to map out. And if you look at the red and the pink curves, you see that there's a destructive interference which comes when you include not just the Higgs contribution, but the continuum diagrams, these glue-glue to ZZ loops. And the same thing happens in vector boson fusion, which is the green and the blue. And again, you see they cross over at some point. So of course, there's a smaller rate in vector boson fusion, clearly just looking at the order of these curves, but the sort of greater sensitivity actually out here in the tail, essentially because one's a tree process, the other's a loop. And because it's tree versus loop, when you look out here, you're less susceptible to not knowing, for instance, what's running around that loop. So, this is something we want to look at to, as I said in the introduction, look at this cancellation that's demanded by unitarity. Work out is the Higgs, the whole story. This effect, this cancellation, is mediated by the top quark loops. So those are the ones that are coupling to the longitudinal Zs. And what you see here, here's the Higgs contribution, the black line, and here's the interference, which is the total interference, which is this blue line, and you see these are sort of mirror images in this line at zero. But there's a big uncertainty. That's what these dashed lines are meant to represent here. And so when you're canceling these guys with a big uncertainty, that's not good. You want to pin this interference down a bit more carefully. And this uncertainty here weakens the indirect constraint on the Higgs width, which was proposed by Kirill and Melnikov a couple of years ago, and that's a program that CMS and Atlas have followed. So what can you do beyond this one loop? Well, I told you that the this is mediated by the top quark loops, and I also already told you that putting the top mass in there, of course, makes things a lot harder. So what you can do is try and go beyond one loop by just taking a leading term in the expansion, so in 1 over mt, or really s over mt squared. And so that's something that Melnikov and Dowling did beginning of last year, and they looked at this, the k factor in this approximation, and saw that that sort of between 1.5 and 2 in just pretty much the same way as the Higgs diagrams alone, their k-factor scales. But of course, you're doing this expansion, so you're sort of limited to the region below the top pair threshold. You can also do this using a soft glue on resummation technique, and essentially the conclusion is the same, that the K factor of this of these contributions scales just like the Higgs one. We tried to extend this in the last year or so. We took beyond 1 over MT, so you up as far as your graduate student can handle, up to 1 over MT to the 12th. Of course, you're still limited by the fact that you can't go above the 2 MT threshold, so you try and figure out how you can get around that. So we used a conformal map, we used some Pardee approximants, and you start to get nervous a little bit. Then you try and reassure yourself by doing some scaling to the exact result that you know at leading order. So that's what we did. And this is just applied to the interference, and now just for on-shell Zs. And since we played all these games, you have to do some as good an estimate as you can of how badly you've how bad you've been. So you vary the number of terms, and then you fudge it a little bit to make yourself a little more conservative. And what you see when we did this is that you get some uncertainty that's at the level of 20% in the bulk of this high MZZ region, which is where you're really interested. We also included the massless quark loops exactly, and after putting it all together, what we found is that the K factor, just like the others had found in these simpler approximations before us, is that the K factor as a function of the invariant mass is essentially identical to the Higgs, which as you go to infinity has to be the case since these guys have to cancel. It sort of fails as you get near the 2 MZ threshold, and that appears to be a feature just of the massless loops. And we did a first pass at how this might impact this methods of constraining the Higgs width, and including scale variation and this uncertainty coming from this large mass expansion where we had to play some games. And we find that the scale uncertainty is still the leading effect, so that makes us feel a little better. And that what we find is that the impact on this interference contribution is relatively small when you take the ratio of off-shell to on-shell, because all these K factors are scaling in more or less the same way. And the uncertainty looks much better, so we think that's good news. This is also, shortly after our paper, Keol et al. Did a similar analysis, slightly different way, only going up to the top threshold, to be honest, but including off-shell bosons decay is something that we hadn't done. And again, they find essentially the same. So the story seems to be coherent here, but we're still awaiting, of course, the full calculation. So that's gluon fusion. I mean, it's interesting to look at vector boson scattering as well. As I said, the rate's smaller, so it's a little harder. And I think one of the interesting things in vector boson scattering, we saw some experimental results already this morning. It's interesting to think that the sensitivity to the Higgs couplings here, even in modes where there's no S channel. So you can look at like sine Ws. So that's something we played around with. What's nice is that the rate is somewhat small but relatively high because it's W's, and there's a really small QCD contribution. So you see that comes in these guys here, which sort of are otherwise annoying when you look at the other channels and interfere and you have to remove them. And we just went back and reinterpreted the ATLAS evidence for like sine W production to find some a weak bound on the Higgs width. So this is not a fantastic bound, but it's interesting to how this could evolve with more data at 13 TeV. There's not much backgrounds. It's all W plus electroweak when you get out into the tail. Okay. So That analysis I showed you was just at leading order. Of course, all these things are in VBF NLO at next to leading order. Here's an impressive list of what they include. And there you can do off-shell, all of those things, decays. Just a couple of slides to say, you know, I've concentrated on Di bosons. That's, you know, although we're pushing beyond that, it's where really all the precision data is going to be for a while. W gamma gamma is pretty interesting. It's pretty accessible. The rate's rather high. The radiation zero means the higher order corrections have interesting features. So here's a K factor as a function of this rapidity distance, difference between the Di photons and the W. And you see the K factor is as large as 15 or 20, somewhat scary. And I'm sure David's going to tell us more later in the week about pushing the pushing the frontier of Di bosons plus jets, so up to three jets, which is something, of course, we really want to do once we get into, want to understand top backgrounds. Okay, so that's just about brings me to the end. So yeah, I've showed you lots of things, which I hope roughly correspond to sifting results. Definitely some long continued labor over here, and those are what get you to accurate measurements. And of course, as Kelvin told us, that's what you need to maybe have a chance of some of the grandest discoveries. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. So we're on time for questions.
So this top loop contribution to glue to ZZ at large invariant mass looks a lot like glue to Di Higgs. And now that we have that exact calculation there, do you think the approximations you made would reproduce that depression at large invariant mass?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me, that's something we haven't done yet, but it's on our list, right? Because it's obviously they're intimately entwined. It has to be.
Regarding whether the electroweak corrections are additive or multiplicative, I mean, is there any general argument that could be made as to what the preference would be? I mean, is it just known for the Z production, WZ production on resonance, the mixed corrections?
Okay, I mean, that's sort of roughly what I was showing, right? I don't remember.
I mean, that's a big uncertainty, right? Just for any type of correction like that. I'm just wondering, you know, given the complexity of the mixed calculations, is there any theoretical prejudice as to what it's suspected to be?
Of course there's theoretical prejudice. how many theorists in the room would you like?
Let's narrow it down. Informed theoretical prejudice.
Everyone's informed. Yeah, I think that's the only answer, right? I would say that everything else. Where is it? I'm getting the wrong way. Right. So this sort of curve where you do both. That's sort of an estimate of your ignorance, I would say, in the lack of an exact calculation. I don't think I'd be prepared to go out on a limb beyond that.
More questions?
Going back to the photon production, did you use smooth isolation in this case, and did you try to study what happens to your calculation when you vary isolation prescriptions?
For which?
The invariant mass in NLO, the diphoton.
Right, so for this sort of distribution or for...
Yeah, for example, for this one.
Yeah, it makes such a small difference. It's true that right now, we or anyone can do is really the smooth cone prescription at this order. So there is, means there is a mismatch there. However, I mean, what we've tried to do is at the order below, so next to leading order, you can try and see what sort of smooth cone prescription reproduces a fragmentation calculation at some level of accuracy. Of course, there, the uncertainties from the fragmentation functions and everything else muddy the waters a bit, so there's a lot of room. We tried exploring different versions of the smooth cone isolation to explore that parameter space, and it makes very little difference. I mean, when you're making these sorts of comparisons with data, you can see it a little bit, but not very much. As soon as you make this sort of plot on a log scale, I shouldn't say this, but that could have been the NLO curve, and you wouldn't have known the difference. You couldn't, right?
Can I profit from the microphone to add a comment? Actually, I was curious, and I made that study with DiFox, so one order lower, including fragmentation functions. And indeed, it's as John said, the difference for high PT photons is really very small.
The Lesueur Accord, right, probably as you know, due to Gudrun, right, and Daniel and Leandro, just showing that if you use the Fricksioni isolation, that you basically reproduce the results of the experimental analyses using reasonably strict isolation cones. So that's so the best of both worlds, because we can say to the theorist, do what's easiest. We can say to the experimentalist, do what you do anyway.
Which is what would have happened anyway.
So I have a question again about the one of MT expansion. So you do this Padé approximation mapping and so on, and then you validate with Higgs production.
Yes.
But did you have an argument why things should work? Or if things would not have worked out, what...
So in the case of the Higgs, I mean, the Higgs case is very simple because, of course, you develop this branch cut and it works perfectly.
But it's related to whether you expect it to work in more complicated cases. So what are the arguments why you...
I mean, I would say there's not a strong argument for knowing that it should work. I mean, it's the best we could come up with, I think, is the honest answer.
For John? Seems not. Okay, so let's thank John.